Welcome to episode 3 of A Legitimate Salvage, your rewatch or watch for the first time, whichever, of The Expanse. We are usually 4 Doctor Who fan friends who are trying to watch every episode of The Expanse, get them all in before the season 4 premiere on Amazon Prime this December. But now there are only 3 of us. I'm Chip Sutterth.
I'm Jen Burt.
And I'm Katie Burt.
And Warren Fry is on assignment. Mm.
I feel like we should have come up with some sort of clever Expanse-related reason that he was not here. But we did not do that.
We kicked him off of a rock hauler, and he is floating in space hoping for somebody to notice him.
That's so terrifying.
That doesn't bode well for us. You're using this parallel.
Oh, right.
But I'm into it. You know, I can't complain.
So we are taking a look at episodes 5 and 6 of the first season. That's Back to the Butcher and Rock Bottom. And as usual on the podcast, we are going to talk about these 2 episodes and everything that came before them in a nice spoiler-free manner for those of you who are taking advantage of this podcast to watch The Expanse for the first time. And then we'll take a bit of a spoiler break, and then we'll talk about these episodes and everything that happened afterward and just sort of the big, wonderful, expansive context of it all. That pun never gets old.
No.
So first up, let's do some clever episode synopses, and then we'll talk about the episodes in depth. The first episode was Back to the Butcher. January 5th, 2016 was the original air date, and this one is just chock full of nonlinear storytelling. So, you know, I'm not saying that I kept exhaustive notes, but I am saying that I did hire an administrative assistant for this. 2 main plot lines in all of the jumping around. The first is former UN Colonel Fred Johnson runs the Tycho space station that's been building a generation ship for Mormons, and he offers Holden and his companions, Holden's gang, Holden's fam, safe passage to Tycho. They can't decide where to go, in part because Fred Johnson has a history as the butcher of a space station full of protesting belters 11 years ago. But they have nowhere else to go, so they set course and meanwhile explore the ship, and it is nice. It has coffee. Real coffee. And Johnson helps them change the transponder code, thus renaming the ship, and the former MCRN Tachi is now the Rosinante. Cue, like, horns or something. Meanwhile, Detective Joe Miller's kind of a jerk. He's unsympathetic to the recovering Havelock. He insults Havelock's friend who was helping him understand Belter culture. And he ignores Anderson Dawes' offer of access to the guy who spiked Havelock. Instead, he continues the Julie Mao case, finding a link between a ship that left the now wiped out Phoebe station and the Scopuli, which was the ship that Julie set off on. That's also, coincidentally, the ship that the Canterbury tried to rescue. Miller tracks down Julie's associate, who confirms that she was deep into the OPA, and points him toward her data broker's stash. Miller doesn't find anything except a clue that sends him back to Julie's apartment. He finds a data cube there, hides it in his hat, and no sooner does he walk out the door than a couple of folks slap a bag over his head. And I'm sorry, but after his behavior today, I think he had it coming, and he needs to sit with himself. And that was Back to the Butcher.
And then we have episode Rock Bottom, which aired on January 12th, 2016. So first, Christian returns after having been absent the previous episode. She's on a trip to the aquarium with her grandson, and she uses that time to also blackmail her colleague, who has a son who's up for parole. She wants access to his spy on Tycho Station so she can figure out what's happening with Fred Johnson. Later, Erin Wright admonishes her for the blackmail, says she's making things personal, and reveals that she has a son that was killed by the OPA. On Tycho Station, the Rossi crew arrives there and begins negotiating with Fred Johnson to maintain control of their ship. Well, he kind of wants to use them, and the fact that they have Holden, who is the most kind of famous face in the galaxy right now. But then they eventually form an alliance that they agree to take on a mission to find Lionel Polyansky, the sole survivor of the Scopuli. Meanwhile, good old Diogo is working with his uncle Mateo, harvesting rocks, when they are pulled over by Martian space cops for essentially having an expired registration. They're kind of hassled by them, and this really sets off Uncle Mateo. This is the last straw, and he decides to take a stand and goes on a suicide mission against the Martian cops, leaving Diogo floating in space. And finally, on Sirius, Miller gets tortured and interrogated by Dawes and his minions. Also kind of a time for Dawes to give some family backstory, and they go back and forth about the righteousness of the OPA, but also he fails to notice the data cube that Miller has hidden his hat, which leaves Miller then thrown in the airlock, but luckily Mus saves him, but also murders two of the OPA members in the process. At which point, Miller approaches his boss, Shadid, to share his theories and the information he's gotten from the data cube. Turns out she's in Dawes's pocket and fires Miller. And that is rock bottom.
Personally, I find these reviews very helpful, even though I just watched these episodes yesterday. A lot happens.
A really lot happens. And not exactly a spoiler, but we've watched 3 weeks worth of 6 episodes. And we're more than halfway through the first season, which is just wild.
I know. I didn't realize there were only 10 episodes. So this is big. We've reached the more than halfway point. These also, it's funny because so much happens in these episodes, but I feel like they're actually slower in a lot of ways than the first 4 episodes we watched. So
for sure,
things are slowing down a little bit.
Especially episode 5, Back to the Butcher. It felt almost kind of like, at least as far as James, Naomi, Alex, and Amos, it's just like slice of life stuff, you know?
Yeah, it's like the first time they're not literally just like getting shot at or almost blown up or anything like that. I mean, they have to figure out, kind of make a decision about where they want to go, but... yeah, they get to drink coffee.
Or liquor, depending on your vice.
Yeah.
Yeah, which reminds me, that ship is just really, really nice.
They really lucked out.
They did. It's almost like wish fulfillment. I remember when I was a kid playing Dungeons & Dragons, and I created a backstory for my characters, and those backstories were all about wish fulfillment, and they had the... You know, they had the equivalent of the nicest car, you know, and the best house or castle or whatever. You know, it just feels kind of wild that the four of them have just lucked into this perfect ship that has coffee. And
I find Holden so relatable in the moment where he finds the whole, and also delightful. His face just lights up with such joy.
And then when he drinks it, he looks a little less wholesome.
Yeah. It is interesting, too, because to go off your point of how nice the Rossi is, there is kind of an allusion to that when Fred Johnson is like, oh, I'll take your ship off your hands. And they're like, no, 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 no. We know what we have, which is like, you know, any independent vessel they had that was their own, would any legitimate salvage would be worth holding on to. But it seems especially vital to hold on to something that is probably very expensive and hard to come by if you're not Martian military.
I do adore that Naomi complains that she's an engineer who has nothing to fix on the Rocinante because it's perfect. And then there's a little tear in the padding on a wall there, and she just tears it a little more just to feel a little bit at home. It's too perfect.
And there's that nice moment where Amos is like, you fixed my leg. Just like kind of also highlighting how up until that point, they are forced to, or we're forced to see them, and they're probably forced to see themselves as like, what are their most relevant skills? And obviously, you know, any medical attention is probably relevant in a lot of situations they've been on. But Naomi is so defined up until this point by her identity as an engineer. And now she gets to, you know, the fact that she's also a friend here, and you know, we get that great shot where everyone's kind of enjoying their time on the Rossi to a certain extent, and she's just like curled up on her bunk, and you just get a sense that there's so much more going on with her character, which I think we already knew, but like we were saying, there's just a lot more time to breathe in this episode and have those sorts of moments.
I also, when Alex is talking about how nice, he's always wanted to fly a ship like this, It's a ship that has all of the Martian kind of like some weaponry, you know, not a ton considering it's a smaller ship, but also it's just, he says it's the most fun he's ever had getting to fly this ship, which is very revealing of where he's coming from.
His work history, even for the Martians.
Yeah.
All four of the characters, you know, you're right. They're not fleeing death in these episodes.
Not as actively.
So we get a little bit more of a measure of who they are. Holden and the rest of them, they start feeling like they're beginning to gel. And in Rock Bottom, when they arrive on Tycho and there's this bit of a standoff in the airlock and somebody else is trying to break into the ship and they anticipated that and they've got guns trained on Fred Johnson's guys, you know. And Holden has a bit of a smirk and you suddenly realize that he's got a little bit of game.
Holden, tell the butcher to call off his men, or I'll have Alex vent his bloody station.
How's it going out there?
Sir, we have a problem.
So, there's a really interesting decision this episode makes with Fred Johnson, because we do get to see him in the present day Holden and company storyline, but there's also the Belter flashback storyline, which is integrated pretty like without fanfare into the rest of the episode in terms of like, and then there's this thing that's happening 11 years ago with the Belters. But I thought it was really interesting that they make the decision not to reveal that it's Fred Johnson, who is the butcher of Anderson Station, until the end of the episode.
With and a I'm caption. Curious.
Yeah, I know. Oh, I didn't even think of that. But you're right. It is like, it's very bold. And I do wish that they just like held a little bit longer on him in terms of like, I didn't totally understand what his role was on that ship. But so I do think maybe there's something lost by not showing more of him early, but I think totally by not showing him, you also totally align with the Belters. Mm-hmm. Although I can't imagine ever not, given the power dynamics at play and how horrific that, I was going to say tragedy, but massacre is.
Yeah. I mean, there is a lot of Belter politics in these two episodes, and there's almost no question of who we need to sympathize with, even even though there are rough types like Anderson Dawes out there, you get a sense of how they got where they are.
I also think it's interesting that Holden, when they first mention working with Fred Johnson, he's like, well, people change, time's gone by, whereas you know Naomi is like, absolutely not, I've known men like this. But I also think it's interesting because both Fred Johnson and Holden have this kind of infamy coming from these specific moments of people transmitting video messages. And obviously, Holden's is on the being on the end of being a survivor of a massacre, whereas Fred Johnson is the perpetrator of a massacre. But I do think it's interesting that they both are these kind of in the news, the talk of the system people.
And they share that experience in some way.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that it's Fred Johnson who is like reaching out in that moment for Holden.
Yeah.
Who obviously, he has motivations of his own. It's not about.
No, it's not about bonding with Holden.
This Holden seems like a nice guy. Yeah, and it is great to see that Belter backstory in relation to all the Anderson Dawes stuff that happens in both episodes. I think I like lose track of where one episode ends and the next begins, but because Anderson Dawes does go from this very like the guy that Miller chats with about Belter politics and identity in the noodle bar to
very
the man who is the man who is torturing and is okay with killing or having his minions kill Miller. Mm-hmm. So it gives context not only obviously to Fred Johnson, but to a character like Anderson Dawes.
The way Daz frames his story of the loss of his sister is very telling. I guess that's another one where Miller's kind of like, everyone knows this story about. And Daz really tries to spin it as like, oh, this was this terrible sacrifice. But it's also very, I guess, somewhat ableist, because he's just like, well, she was sick, so she was a drag on the resources, which also feels out of character for a lot of Belters. I feel like there's a lot of times where there's this sense of limited resources and we all have to share them, because once we start cutting out the, you know, who gets these resources, they're all kind of screwed in the belt. He's such a good storyteller that in some ways when he's telling the story, now I see all these people as my brothers and sisters. You're like, oh, wow, this is terrible plight of the Belters and Daz. But also, it's just such a terrible story that he sacrificed his sister in some way.
Yeah, it's really grim and it's unforgivable. And that's one of the few moments in these stories where it feels clear to me that Miller has the moral high ground.
Absolutely.
Because the rest of these two episodes, I'm kind of on Team Bert now after the last couple of episodes of the podcast where I've been like, you know, I really like Miller. And now in these two episodes, I'm seeing the flaws in Miller's character, which are, you know, sort of intentional. They're intentionally drawn that way. But man, he's a jerk.
I know, it's like, how many other people who actually knew Julie Mao as well have to tell him that they didn't manipulate her, that she was just like doing something that she believed in, for him to like see her in a different, and like not as the damsel in distress who needs to be saved.
Right.
He talks to multiple people, but you're right, he's also just like not caring about Havelock very much, like enough to
at
like
all.
Yeah, like I guess he shows up to his like hospital room or whatever, but he's
and
like
yells at him for getting hurt.
Yeah. I know, poor Havelock.
And as the audience, we know that Havelock and Havelock's friend, whose name escapes me at the moment, that she's blameless in all of this. We know that Miller doesn't, but Miller doesn't have any evidence to jump.
He hasn't bothered to find out.
Yeah.
Either way.
Yeah. So he's just a complete ass to her, and a complete ass to Havelock. He's not great to Muss. You know, his assistance, his bedside manner when she's trying to recover from having shot the two OPA guys is horrible.
Mm-hmm.
She's right. His advice is terrible. You know.
Yeah,
I think
I do feel like Miller. There were a few moments in this episode where I was just like, I don't know if it's his like his hair is just out and messy, or like he does a lot of things that I find very like endearing and relatable. I don't know why I'm going down this path, but I still think he is the worst in a lot of ways. But like the moment where he's trying to figure out how to say Anubis is really funny to me, or spell Anubis,
right?
I think because the episodes here seem to be more aware of Miller's shortcomings, like you were saying, Chip, it's easier. Like, I feel like I don't have to do that as much. Like, I don't need to call them out in the same way, or it doesn't irritate me in the same way, which probably says more about me than it does about Miller or the show.
Right. Well, this is the first time when, like, characters on the show pretty much brand him as a screw-up. Mm. And I think that's the first time that we get the hint in the story that he is not actually this super detective. He's not your guy. He's not Jimmy Smith's in NYPD Blue. He is. He's just kind of a sad sack.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think Daz says, you know, you're the station screw up or whatever. Maybe it's Daz or maybe it's.
Yeah, I think it is Daz.
But then there's also that point where Muss is kind of like, I think this is above your pay grade. And instead of kind of like taking a step back and be like, yeah, I have kind of uncovered this like potential huge conspiracy. I mean, I don't know if she's right that he should go to a superior, because obviously his superior fires him at the end of this and has her own agenda. But he could at least like he keeps calling in Muss to help. And instead of in that moment being like, well, maybe I'm not going to go to our boss, but Could we work together on this? Or could we think about how to do this? He's just so offended. And you're just like, man, this is not about your lone, hero, savior thing that you're doing here. This is actually affects so many people. It's not about you saving Julie Mao.
This isn't about your plot to steal all of the photos of Julie Mao that exist on Ciri Station. Which I think is maybe his biggest dick move from these two episodes. I'm like, that guy is maybe in love with her, or at least had some sort of relationship, and you just kind of stole that photo.
Yeah. So for you two, where is the needle on the Miller's motivation dial? On one end, it's Dawes laughs at Miller and says, "You're in love with her." On the other end, he tells Musk that he thinks that Julie Mao is in the middle of a big conspiracy here. So is he lovesick or is he a conspiracy obsessed?
A little bit of both, probably.
I do think that he didn't uncover the conspiracy part of this until really the last few episodes, and was very driven previously by something else.
Yeah.
But yeah, I agree that it doesn't have to be one or the other. And when Dawes has that line, I think I said to Jen, I was like, I don't know, what would we call it? Because I don't know if he can be in love with her if he's never met her. But obviously there's some sort of compulsion or obsession, or I don't know. I don't want to say affection. I just feel like those are the wrong words, but I don't know if we have the right words. I did read a review of one of these episodes that was talking about how the reviewer was saying they see it less as being in love with Julie Mao and more of wanting to believe in something, which I don't fully agree with either. But I do think maybe that is connected to these other two motivations and is in there as well. Yeah, maybe not wanting to be the laughingstock of the station if that's what he fears he is to a certain extent. But I also don't know how Julie Mao or finding her would. It's not a thing that feels as connected to his belter identity that he is betrayed to a certain extent as other mysteries might that he could solve that are right there and available.
Right. And another thing, which we noted before, he seems to have a weakness for young women or girls in distress, which is or is not necessarily creepy in and of itself. But the story that he tells about his first and only kill as a Star Helix cop, and the thing that broke him was a 4-year-old girl watching the whole thing. He's got an issue with damsels in distress, I think.
Confirmed.
Yeah.
So we've psychoanalyzed the heck out of Miller once again. One last question on that, though. Do we think more or less of him that he didn't take advantage of the opportunity for a little vigilante justice against the guy who nearly killed his partner?
I think maybe a little less, because what is that guy going to do now? You know, not necessarily as a revenge, but Dawes is this guy's gonna just go off and live his life somewhere else. So I assume he could just, stab someone else. So I feel like not taking the opportunity to, I don't know. I mean, I guess I don't know what justice looks like in this system either. I don't know what happens. Would he?
Is there a Belter court system?
Yeah. So I don't think I know enough about it to really have a strong opinion, but the fact that he doesn't even try to figure out what happened with Havelock, I do think makes me think a little bit less of him, because this is someone who he has spent a fair amount of time with and has some sort of a relationship with. But I also don't think revenge is a worthy goal.
Yeah. So I think that in these two episodes, we actually have three great love stories. We've got Miller and his love for this case / for Julie Mao. We've got Holden and Holden's crew developing their great love for the Rocinante. And then we've got Christian with her great love of winning.
her great love of fish.
Yeah. Blackmailing a guy with an aquarium with the most direct, even the guy just is like, you don't waste any time. You just go for the jugular right now. She's scary.
She is scary. Jed was also, like, at that point, the fact that this is the second kind of, like, grandmother moment where Christian is just kind of not prioritized at all her grandchild. Jen was just like, she's not a great grandmother, which is fine.
Or she's just someone that prioritizes. It seems like she's very much prioritizing this career that she's chosen. And it's just like, what? You could go get sweets.
Yeah. Or I wonder, too, if, you know, does she ever take this kid to the aquarium when she doesn't need to
blackmail
someone else? Maybe, maybe not. It's a beautiful setting, though.
So my last question before we go into spoiler space here is the plot, or at least the backstory, is being like steadily revealed in dribs and drabs now. We get Fred Johnson telling Holden that he sent the scopuli. We have the scopuli intercepting a ship that left Phoebe Station, which Mars was investigating because it got all wiped out. We don't know what was going on over there, except that it probably had something to do with some kind of bioweapon, according to the data that Miller found in Julie Mao's apartment. So it's all sort of coming together. We've seen this show before. We know where this is going, but did you find yourself pausing periodically as you watch this or just reminding yourself? Because it is really dense and it's happening really fast in these two episodes.
Oh, yeah. There's definitely parts that they're just laying the groundwork for stuff that I feel like doesn't come to fruition for some of it till, you know, season three. And the levels of, without revealing too much, there's a lot of people who have, everyone has their own agenda. And I'm trying to remember, what is their agenda? Who is actually working for who? Like, the reveal at the end of when Miller's fired, I'm like, I don't remember. Is she really? I guess she's working for Dawes, but some of this stuff, I'm just like, I just don't remember.
Yeah, and I think it actually made me appreciate Miller's detective work a little bit more than I usually do, because I'm still not sure how Anderson Dawes doesn't find the chip in his hat, but because he's searching it. But I think when Miller kind of puts it all together for his and presents it to his boss, I'm just kind of like, whoa, really? You know that much? And like having him spell it out like that, I'm like, okay, you actually, you know, you got the clues, you did the work. But it's still a lot. And I think the first time I watched the show, I didn't really understand or what was happening, and also didn't care enough to really like about that part of it, because it still felt like such a mystery. And there's so much good character stuff in these episodes that I didn't feel a need to really like make it clear to myself.
Yeah. I lied. I've got one more piece of pre-spoiler stuff to mention, and that is going back over to the newly named Rosinante.
The Flying Alamo.
Now that they're done fleeing and they have a chance to breathe, they also have a chance for some conversations that are not about ensuring that they are going to be breathing in the next 5 minutes. Holden tells Amos and Alex that he logged the distress call and was and ultimately everything that happened as a result after that, he feels like it's his fault. Naomi reveals to Amos that she already knew and didn't tell him. That pisses Amos and Alex off. They walk off the ship and they go get drunk at a bar and, you know, all kinds of conversations. And then in the end, they're all together on the Rosinante. You know, Fred Johnson wants to send the ship out to track down the last survivor of the scopuli. And Naomi, Alex, and Amos decide that they want to come along. They were almost at each other's throats not so long ago. 6 episodes into the first season, and they feel like a team. Too fast?
It doesn't feel too fast to me. I'm not sure if I remember it feeling too fast the first time I watched it. I think there are a few things that maybe let me buy it a little more. One, that's like a sweet ship. Like, what else are they going to do, right? Like, they're going to go back to be on Ice Holler. Like, on some level, you're like, oh, well, this does seem
cushier,
like, cushy, in some way. But also, I do think there is something to be said for going through these traumatic experiences together. And I do think there is something to be said for the fact that Holden comes back to get them when they're on the Martian ship. I think at some point in this episode, Naomi does say, like, I don't know if I would have done that necessarily. So even though I don't think Amos and Alex kind of echo that same sentiment, I do think, man, Holden, he really shows himself to be kind of a loyal, maybe kind of fool. Like, what is...
He's like a puppy.
Fred Johnson says something about... you know,
he's either
a genius or the luckiest in the galaxy. And there is something to be said for, man, he did cause some of what's happened to them, but also I don't know. I might want to, like, kind of throw my luck in with him if my options were limited.
Right. And then when they're strapping themselves in the final shots of the episode, you know, there he is coming out of the galley with coffee for everybody. You know, that's just that's actually kind of touching.
Yeah, well, it's really generous because it's obviously a resource that isn't very common, especially maybe if you don't have a lot of money. And he obviously is very excited that the ship has coffee, but he's, you know, already sharing it with other people. And I think to answer your original question, for me, if anything, it's a little too slow how quickly they come together, because I think, after one of the things they've been to, through together, I feel like that would already cement them in some really, like, firm ways. But I also think that, you know, obviously they get upset when Holden mentions that he logged the distress call, but I think the fact that Holden chooses to share it with them when he doesn't have to is also really probably... You know, I think that would make me trust Holden more. And also the fact that they all kind of discuss it and Naomi also comes clean. Yeah, I'm like, you guys are already having, like, better conversations as, like, roommates than I have had in a lot of my living situations. So good job. Oh,
good job, apparent crew of the Rosinante. I think we're ready to talk about the rest of the seasons and what happened here and how it affects the future, aren't you?
I think so.
Yep.
All right. So now that we're entering the spoiler zone, or about to, if you haven't watched past episode 6 of the first season and you don't want to be spoiled, now's the time to put on your helmet and go out of the airlock. But I hope you'll come back next week for our discussion of episode 7, which is Windmills, and episode 8, which is Salvage. I like that name. You can subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, on Google Podcasts, on Stitcher, on, you know, wherever you can log in. But we are on the web at theincomparable.com/salvage, and we're on Twitter at @LegitSalvage. Katie, Jen, let's dive into the future of The Expanse. You know, these two episodes were basically the secret origin of the Rosinante. And when I was watching this for the first time, you know, I had heard a couple of references to people who love the books talking about the Rossi. But I'm not sure that I would have picked up, even after these two episodes all by themselves, how big a deal the Rosinante would be as, you know, their home and their character, almost a character in its own right.
I know they've switched ships so often and obviously lost members of their crew. I don't think I probably knew at this point how integral this core group of characters would be, not only to the show, but to one another. But I think at this point I was invested in them. Like, I really hoped that they would be sticking around and that they'd be spending time together.
This is the beginning of the formation of this family of four characters. And they're going to have some bumps along the way when Naomi gives up the protomolecule, et cetera, and so on. But this is basically the core cast of the show, especially once the storylines converge between Miller and the rest of them, and then Miller gets killed off. You know, Mm-hmm. These four are the show.
Yeah, and I think you're right. The other storylines change so much from what they are, not only in terms of who's interacting or who's important there, but in terms of even where those characters are. Like, we get this whole arc with Christian where she's, you know, not on Earth. For me, the real interest in watching these early episodes in relation to the Rossi crew, or one of them, is, like, in conversations like the one they have where Holden admits that he was the one, when they basically reveal a truth about, you know, something they've been keeping secret from the others, is thinking about that big Naomi, like, betrayal, if that's what it was, and seeing how they deal with other, arguably smaller, moments like that. Because I'm such a Naomi defender. I'm just like, you guys, that was, I don't know. You know, their emotions are valid. But
yeah.
I do feel like there are a lot of instances of people keeping secrets. And the fact that, you know, Naomi does tell them about that in the same way that Holden, you know, comes clean about this. It's just such a, like, smaller deal. And they're very different situations. Like, Holden had no idea what would happen, but they're both made from, like, people who are trying to do something good or trying to make the best decision they can of the options they have. So in that sense, they're not so dissimilar.
When it comes to Naomi, too, I think it's interesting that rewatching it, thinking about this whole fact that she has a child, there's that scene where she's talking with Fred Johnson and says, sometime I'm going to come back to you and ask you to find someone. And I assume that is her child. But it's so interesting because it is still this huge secret that she has from this family of hers in a way that I really want. Yeah, I just wonder. She's so smart, but she's also so unwilling to give up things of herself if she doesn't have to.
Yeah.
Yeah. In a way that might actually help her. That would be smart.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love Amos and Naomi's relationship. I love their friendship. I think it's just so interesting. So I also think it's interesting how she apologizes to Amos here.
Yes.
Oh, that part where he says, "Are you afraid of me?" is just so heartbreaking to me.
Yeah. Yeah. And in the previous episode, when they sort of negotiate, when they're at the standoff of whether or not to go to Tycho Station, and Amos backs Naomi unquestioningly. And then when they're in private, he tries to talk her out of it. And there is just so much respect between them in that conversation there. And then in the apology in episode 6, you know, that's really compelling stuff. And then I don't remember how they were when they reconciled after she gave the protomolecule to Fred. You know, it took some time, and he just sort of wrote her off as not the person that I thought she was, and he just sort of coldly moved on. I don't remember how the two of them reconciled, because obviously there is a hell of a lot of reconciling and relational navigation going on between Naomi and James, which we'll get into in a minute. But Amos and Naomi, that's a different one.
And from what I remember, I don't think they really reconcile until she kind of gets back to the Rossi after being away. And he's, you know, they're all, like, he's very injured. And it does feel like a moment of them, you know, realizing they're finally back together as friends and whatever betrayal she's kind of had. I'm really curious to see where that goes in the season.
Yeah, because I think it is relatively open-ended in the sense that Amos seems willing to have a relationship with Naomi again, but it's very far from where they are here, for example. I don't doubt they'll ever be in this point again, but I also think there's other directions where it makes sense for their relationship to grow that also could be healthier.
Yeah, maybe because for a while there, Amos tries to find other people who are kind of his, like, moral compass.
Yeah.
And to what degree he needs that, or to what degree maybe he should have multiple relationships where has, you know, he can look to Naomi, but maybe he can also look to Holden or Alex or whoever.
Like, take a vote on if you should shoot someone.
Yeah.
Yeah, when you have somebody who could go either way, you know, I want him to have as many moral compasses as possible.
Exactly.
I'm a man. So I'm not much of a shipper by trade, and I don't watch a lot of fiction with a whole lot of investment in the romantic pairings of the characters, the 10th Doctor and Rose aside.
yes.
So I don't know how these portmanteaus go, whether the fans online call it Naomi's or Nagadin or however you combine James and Naomi's names together. But anyway, I really love the scene in the bar where they're toasting Shed and the crew of the Doniger, although Naomi's reluctance is really interesting and really well explained. I wonder how this show would have been if they had just sort of kept it there at that level, as opposed to transitioning Jim and Naomi into a romantic couple. Could they have been friends?
I think for sure. But I also am someone who was rooting for them to get together, but not like I think I would. I do. I am someone who ships Chip. And like my favorite shows tend to have romance in them or the potential for romance. So I think I enjoyed that part of it. I'd be open to it in other storylines between other characters or with these characters with other people. But I definitely, it was something I was invested in, I remember. Probably not this early on. Like at this point, I'm just kind of like, oh, look, they're having a conversation.
Yeah, there's no indication that that's where this is going to go at this point.
There's just a few moments where Holden looks at her and you can kind of, see some level of like, he smiles a few times where you're like, oh, okay. Like, and I don't know if I noticed that the first time through, but one of them I think is when she's just like fixing the transponder and renaming the ship. And maybe it's just because he's happy that she succeeded, but I really like that moment because you can tell that he likes her because of how confident she is, which is something I really like about their relationship.
I mean, let's dive deep into that for a second. You know, they have the conversation about what to name the ship. Holden comes up with the name. Amos concurs. They agree on it. Holden types in the name of the ship into the transponder and then flips it over to Naomi and allows her to sort of make the final decision and to press submit. You know, he could have hit that button, but he actually turns it over to her. It's almost it's almost offering her consent on the name change of the ship.
I feel like in that moment I was like, she's captain. But I do agree that that is something I really love about their dynamic, because they are people who are both, they've been presented in some way as like vying for the same position sometimes that can be like, you know, yeah, like a powerful woman can be like a deal breaker for a man, or like in media and in the real world. So it is cool to see that dynamic where Holden isn't threatened by Naomi, or if he is threatened by Naomi, he doesn't let it affect their relationship. No, I don't think he's threatened. Amos, yes. Naomi, no.
Amos is threatening just by just walking into a room. Yes. He just is.
Wow, they get that character right so early.
Amos?
Yes.
Yeah.
That's all I have to say about that. But yeah, I do like their dynamic, because I also think it brings out different things in these characters that we don't get to see otherwise, and I love that about it. And they are very different in so many ways from each other as well. So to see them come together is cool. And I think it doesn't take up a huge portion of the narrative space, but is always like, it's important, but it's not overwhelming. And it makes sense within the context of the story and the show.
At no point does the story get derailed, or do the characters get derailed by merely pining for each other.
Yeah. It's a very, I guess it's a very adult relationship in some ways, in a way that TV relationships often aren't. And also sometimes real life relationships.
Yeah. I wanted to bring up again Miller the Screw-Up and how we feel about his arc at this point, because where he winds up, leaving aside for the moment the holographic projection in season three, Dawes goes after him as a traitor to the Belters. And then after he hooks up with Holden and company on Eros, you know, he gets a haircut. He gets a Belter haircut. You know, he gets Diogo as his, like, best friend forever. You know, he becomes full-on Belter. And then he sacrifices himself to convince the protomolecule and what's left of Julie Mao in the protomolecule to crash the asteroid on Venus instead of on Earth. The episode title is Rock Bottom, and it took me a while to figure out that they're basically referencing Miller because he is at rock bottom, as you know, in addition to the pun with the Belter ship. Yeah, how do we feel about Miller's arc at this point?
It does feel like a real rock bottom. Like, I'm trying, I definitely know that at some point I felt more warmly to Miller. It is when some point when he kind of joins the Rossi crew. But I'm also fuzzy on, like, how that happens. And I'm curious to see where his kind of change of heart really happens. Because right now he still feels he is kind of a traitor in some ways to the Belters. And I'm really curious to see where that happens.
Yeah, more than just, like, or in addition to being rock bottom, that implies, like, a turning point. Mm. And I think near-death experience, fired from your job, put together the beginnings of a, you know, system-wide conspiracy. There's a lot to motivate one in a different direction than they've been currently moving there. So yeah, I agree with Jen, because I do think I warm to Miller. And I actually do think I enjoyed him a bit more during the last two episodes. So we'll see. I'll keep you both updated.
Yeah. I think that makes such a difference for the show when the narratives crash into each other and you've got Holden and Miller marching through Eros and dealing with radiation sickness, and then Miller on the Rossi and them having that great dinner table conversation about cheese farts, that bonding there.
Do you think you'd feel differently about Miller's arc and Julie's arc, I guess, if we got Julie, like, earlier? I was thinking about this as I was watching these episodes, because we do get that really cool episode where we see all that she's been through, and it's so much her episode, and that is a really cool structural choice, and I wouldn't necessarily change that, but I'm curious how I would feel about his search if we knew Julie a little bit more ourselves, and yeah, if those moments were intercut somehow, like, you know, we've already seen them with the Belter flashback story just have an out of time, like, parallel edited story in an episode. So what would that look like if we were checking in with Julie and her initial or her story that happens before this main story begins?
I think you've got a real good point there, because even though we will get some extended flashback stuff with Julie, and we will also see her, you know, her protomolecule form later on, you know, by and large, Julie is an object more than a character, mm-hmm. because we don't see her in real time alongside the other characters that we've gotten to know. So I can't help but look at Miller as objectifying Julie Mao, and therefore I think less of the Miller character.
Yeah, and maybe are we forced to objectify Julie Mao in the same way because we actually don't have any other information, or we learned so much about her character through his perspective. And that's like, maybe that's why I don't like Miller, because I blame Miller from my own perspective of Julie Mao. I also wonder if I'd be more invested in, like, if his detectiving would have more urgency if I knew her to a certain point or extent, and or thought she is definitely alive, which I can't remember watching this the first time if I thought she was alive or not, or if I cared.
Right.
But it is interesting to see like Jen was pointing out that Dawes talks about her in the past tense to Miller.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we don't know at this point that Lionel is actually her alias and that she is the last survivor. We don't know that at this point. So we either had a feeling or just guessed, but the story doesn't give us anything to go on.
And speaking of Miller's future sidekick, Diogo, I'm curious how you feel about him after rewatching this episode, the episode that features him. Any changes?
I did feel sorry for him hanging out there in space, but he still feels like enough of a screw up. It required a little bit of additional work to get an appropriate level of sympathy for the position that he was in. And it's a good thing we were wrapping up our discussion at that point, because that's when the internet gave out and the Burts and I couldn't hear each other again. So this brings to a close episode 3 of A Legitimate Salvage. We'll be back next week to discuss episode 7 of the first season of The Expanse, Windmills, and episode 8, Salvage. Until then, for Jen Burt and Katie Burt, I'm Chip Sutterth. We will be joining you, hopefully with the floating in space Warren Fry, next week on A Legitimate Salvage. Take care.